Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Everybody, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. It's a hot day in Brooklyn, so I'm very grateful to be inside our cool, dark recording studio. Donna Yen,
hello.
Joined me, our editorial assistant, whose title will be changing soon, right, Donna?
Yes.
Donna's hanging out with us. I'd like to think you're here just because of the company and because we're really excited about today's guest, but it might just be because our office is so hot.
I know. It's crazy in there. Yesterday, Carrie had the blinds completely down. I'm like, what's happening here? That's the only way to keep the office cool.
And it worked. It worked. That one room was cool. Our poor intern was in the kitchen organizing stuff for us. And I think, yeah. But she's young. She'll live. Okay. Today's show is sponsored by Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school with locations around the globe. Be sure to check out our sweepstakes with Le Cordon Bleu. You could win culinary classes in Paris, London, or Ottawa, plus airfare from New York, hotel, and a little spending money. Just visit cherrybomb.com to enter. And we have a brand new sponsor. We're very excited about this. Castor and Pollux, makers of the brand new purposeful pet food line, Pristine. A lot of Bomb Squad members are proud pet parents, so you'll want to know about this responsibly sourced and grain-free line. Visit purposefulpetfood.com for more. It's a lot of alliteration in there. I'm a lot of peas, hopefully. I'll get better at reading that because they're sponsoring us for the season, which we're very grateful for. Donna and I are proud pet parents.
Yes, we are.
I have my rescue. We'll get to you, guest. Pipe down. I have my rescue cat, Dusty.
I have my non-rescue dog, Teddy. But they're pretty much the same. I feel like Dusty's practically a puppy, too.
She is. Dusty and Teddy are more alike than Dusty is with other cats, if that makes sense.
They both like their bellies rubbed.
They do. They do. Teddy's a big love bug, and so is Dusty. And it's fun. We haven't had them at the office at the same time.
We have to do it this summer.
We are going to try. She lived in the streets for like a year. So she must have encountered dogs or saw dogs. But my neighbor just adopted a dog from Egypt, of all places.
Oh, wow.
And they met in the hallway, and Dusty was very just sort of like, who cares? Yeah. She wasn't scared. She wasn't excited. She was just really sort of, you know, little cat shrug. Could have cared less. So we'll see. I have a feeling, though, Teddy will be more... Well, the dog was equally uninterested in her. But I have a feeling Teddy will be super interested in Dusty.
Yeah, a little too interested.
Yes.
Gets in people's business.
And just so everybody knows, we work with sponsors who we really believe in. I did switch Dusty over to Organics cat food. Even though we're going to be talking about their dog food all season, they do make cat food. And I was a little worried, you know, because she's only been fed one type of cat food in the year, almost year that I've had her. But she loved it. She was totally happy with it. So
I need to get Teddy on the
organics. You're next. Teddy's switching to organics, which we already have in motion.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very excited.
All right. So today's guest is none other than Jane Larkworthy. If you're a fan of fashion magazines, you've probably seen Jane's byline over the years. She's a legendary beauty editor and has worked at W, Jane Magazine, and Glamour. Today, she pens a column for The Coveteur. She consults for a variety of clients, and she freelances for magazines like Cherry Bomb. Lucky us. Because Jane loves cooking and entertaining, she launched a blog called The Fraudulent Chef a few years ago. What does it mean to be a fraudulent chef? We're about to find out. Jane Larkworthy, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. We're excited that you're excited. You were shimmying to the theme song.
Yes, I was.
That's always a good sign of an excited guest when they dance along to the theme song in their chair. So what does it mean to be a fraudulent chef?
It means that you kind of don't know what the hell you're doing, but faking it is... we're all frauds, you know? I mean, that's kind of what got me started. So many of my friends, including you, and I consider you one of the people in my lifeboat.
Yes, like, you're in my lifeboat.
Thank you. And so many of my friends are food writers or restaurant owners like yourself. I will go to Christine Mulkey's house and she'll be making a vinegar, or I'll go to your restaurant and have food I've never experienced quite so magically before. And I don't really know what the hell I'm doing, but I feel like if you do a couple trades, like squish a garlic with the fist of your palm, or wear an apron folded down and around, and, you know, just like silly things like that, people think that you know what you're doing. We have people over our house all the time. And my husband and I are not chefs, but we love to cook. And I think if you just have a little good olive oil, garlic, and you're willing to experiment, then your friends think that you know what you're doing.
Wait, that's so true, because I'm in a summer share right now out in the Hamptons. And it's an old house that I've been in years before. And they really don't have, like most shares, not a lot of, you know, fancy stuff in the kitchen. So I brought sharp knives, because that is, if there's one thing you bring to the party, it's a sharp knife. I brought a Vitamix, my Cuisinart, a bunch of ingredients from the Cherry Bomb Pantry that we just have never used. Right. We get so much food there. And a strain, like a sieve. Am I saying that right? A
sieve.
Sieve. Sieve?
I thought it was sieve.
I never know how to say that.
Tomato. S-I-E-V-E.
I brought, and a microplane. I love a microplane. So I brought all that stuff. And literally, I was just, I don't know, I hard-boiled an egg. And half the house was like, I soft-boiled an egg. Half the house was like, oh, are you a chef? And I thought it was so funny, because you're right. Just a few tricks. So many people are intimidated in the kitchen that just a few tricks automatically make you seem like you know what you're doing, even if you don't.
And if you sponge off your friends, if you just kind of observe what they're doing and then you make it your own, that's how I got into cooking. I just, you know, watched my friends make a dish and I thought, all right, that can't be that hard. And then you, like Carrie Brownstein and I talked about this when I interviewed her for Cherry Bomb, you make the recipe your own. You tweak it a little. Maybe you don't like cumin that's in the recipe, and you switch it for nutmeg or something. And it's just, you just kind of figure it out.
I'm sure all the chefs who are listening love when you say, I watched them make a dish and I thought to myself, it can't be that hard. All those years of culinary school, those 10,000 plus hours of slaving away in the kitchen.
At least I own the fraudulence. Okay. It's not like I'm saying the perfect chef.
But I will say, you said, doesn't everybody feel like a fraud? I don't feel like a fraud.
That's because you are, in my opinion, quite the confident person.
Maybe.
The girl who wanted to be the hall monitor in like third grade, when only boys were hall monitors.
Eighth grade, that's right. I'll share that story because Jane knows it. I was in eighth grade and only the eighth graders get to be the crossing guards.
Oh, sorry, crossing
guards. And it was always boys who were the crossing guards. There was never a single female crossing guard. And I get to eighth grade and I had been a feminist, I don't know, I think from the time I popped out of my mom's, you know, uterus, I was a feminist. And I just knew it wasn't fair, and I really wanted to be a crossing guard. And usually, a lot of my early feminism was motivated by a deep sense of fairness and a desire to get out of the classroom. Like, I was very upset that we couldn't be altar girls, and I was mad because the altar boys always got
to
leave.
Got out of school early.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, or during class, I didn't really think it through because they got out of class early to go work
stand.
Funerals.
Right. Right.
But on the weekends, they got to do weddings and they would get like $20 from the best man or something. And I was just like, that's the life. Mm-hmm. And girls were not allowed to be altar boys. And I wrote a letter to the cardinal and everything. And I actually got a letter back. And I thought it was bogus. At a very early age, I was very upset by this letter, and I was like, God doesn't care if we're boys or girls, and I still think that way. So anyway, fast forward, that was like fifth grade. Eighth grade, crossing guards, no female crossing guards. I go to Mrs. Cody, who was in charge of the crossing guards, and I said, I don't really think it's fair that women, that the girls don't get to be crossing guards. And she said, you know what? You're totally right. And she said, okay, you can join the crossing guards. Oh, you know what it was? The everybody voted for who the head crossing guards would be.
When you say everybody, you mean the students?
No, I think it was the existing crossing guard. This is such a boring story. I apologize to everyone. I haven't thought about this in a long time.
I think about it all the time.
Okay, so we had to vote on who would be the head of the crossing guards. So I said, Mrs. Cody, the boys will never vote for me. There's never been a woman who's a girl who's the head of the crossing guards. And she said, okay, you're right. This year we'll appoint the heads of the crossing guards. That did not make me very popular, but it was me and a guy named Matthew Santamoro. And we were co-captains of the crossing guards. And yeah.
I bet Matthew isn't a fraud either. Because he was a crossing guard.
And I'm sure everyone out there listening is riveted.
Yeah, we have one person listening now.
Sorry,
which is
everybody.
My husband. Sorry, everyone else.
All right, so back to Jane. So I think what you're talking about is a little bit of imposter syndrome, which Padma Lakshmi talked about at our conference. And
Eva Chen talked about it, like fake mm-hmm. it till you make it.
Mm-hmm.
That's
exactly.
kind of the ethos.
Did even though you had great success in your magazine career, did you feel like a fraud or
always.
An imposter?
Always, yeah. I think from the very beginning, I always thought, why am I here? Am I well educated enough? Am I stylish enough? Am I whatever? And it's not fishing for any kind of compliment. I think it's probably, you know, insecurities are very deeply rooted. So it's hard to get out of them. I think for the most part, I have gotten out of it. I think the reason I call myself the fraudulent chef now is twofold. It's to bring humor to it, which is what I try to do with all aspects of my life. But also, it's an excuse. So if I do mess something up, I can be like, I never professed to be certified. I'm just fraudulent.
So,
and for the blog, make it relatable.
Mm-hmm.
Take away mm-hmm. any kind of intimidation. And you talk about this all the time, the intimidation factor, like the preciousness of restaurants. And like Samin talked about that, and the preciousness of
Samin
cooking.
Samin Nasrat, who just wrote Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, our favorite cookbook of the moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have the book?
Of course I do.
It's great.
I'm giving one to my stepdaughter, too.
It's so great. We were actually at...
last night.
Books Are Magic in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn, because Samin was there. And Donna, you were there. It was packed.
Oh, good.
Yeah. It was packed and hot.
My impression of her, when you and I went to see her at the 92nd Street Y, I think I told you this, I was so moved by how jolly she is. She just giggles with every answer. I listened to her on Dinner Party Download on Sunday, and it's just infectious mm-hmm. what a happy disposition she has.
Yeah,
do you agree? Like it's.
I agree. I feel like she just like feeds off of that too. And we're asking, like, are you yes. tired from this whole book tour? She said, no. Like this gets me pumped. I'm excited, and she's just excited to like you know spread her message. And that's great.
You know what I think it is? Was she wearing clogs last night?
She was wearing that Mexican dress that has become like her signature dress. You can see it on my Instagram.
I chalk it up to clog wearing because I think if you wear clogs, which I'm wearing today, you are just that much ahead of things and happiness because clogs are comfortable.
So the secret to everything is clogs.
The secret to that's going to be my next blog.
or do a clog blog.
You laugh now.
You heard it here first, everybody. So Samin's on the show next week.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Well, kind of a touching story. So I got a copy of it signed for Astrid, my stepdaughter. And over July 4th weekend, she was up at our house in the Berkshires with a bunch of her friends from college. And at one point or another, they all opened Samin's book and were reading from it. And every time we gathered in the kitchen at one point or another, a different guest would pipe in and say, so I was reading about acid. And they would tell some anecdote about it. The next person would be like, well, I was reading about salt. And they just ate it up, which is, you know, that's what you want out of your cookbook.
Mm-hmm. I brought my copy out to the beach, and because it's a cookbook you can read. It's not just pretty pictures and recipes and all that. Like, you can actually spend some time with it. That's the idea behind it. And people are just mesmerized when they pick up the book. It's a magical book. I was thinking about it in terms of like music or movies, and you know every time around Oscar season, there's always some breakout movie that you never expected would be the buzzed about movie of the season, and that's really what Samin's book is. You know, it's even though she worked on it forever, she's been in this industry forever. She's sort of an overnight success, you know, in the same way that most overnight successes are not really overnight successes. But it just feels like Samin kind of came from out of nowhere. But it must be really gratifying because she did work for so many years on that cookbook to have it be so well received.
Well, when she was introduced at the 92nd Street Y, maybe it was Julia who said it, but Turchin, sorry, who said, you know, she's the next
Julie. Julie Turchin interviewed Samin at the 92nd right. Street Y.
Someone said, it could have been you to me, or someone said, she's the next Julia Child. And it reminds me of, there's a Breaking Bad episode where the Aaron Paul character is in therapy, and his therapist, no, he's in like an AA meeting or, you know, some meeting like that. And the guy leading the meeting, after he tells his story, says, that's very Kafka-esque. So then Aaron, what's his name in the show?
I didn't watch Breaking Bad.
Okay.
Sorry.
Jesse.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So then Jesse, for the rest of the episode, every time he talks to one of his drug dealers, he's like, it's very Kafka-esque. And it reminds me of how I'm going around saying to everyone about Samin's book now. Samin knows her. You don't know this book? She's the next Julia Child.
I'm sure her publisher will be very happy to hear that. They are listening. But we will make sure Samin knows that when we see her later. So back to food. So you... Yeah. You love to cook, and you love mm-hmm. to entertain, and mm-hmm. a lot of people, especially in New York City, because most of our apartments are so tiny, mm-hmm. aren't great about inviting, like, 10 friends over and cooking for all of them, but, you know, you talk about having this fear in the kitchen, but you're a pretty fearless entertainer, unless you're faking that, too, but you're a great hostess.
You're very nice. Thank you. It is the only time, when we entertain, that is the only time that my husband Bertrand and I fight. So if we have more than, the number is around 15, 16. If it gets higher than that, one of us
That's at your place upstate.
That's at our, yeah, we have yes. a house in Massachusetts, and once or twice a month, which is a lot when you think about it, because we're only up there really on weekends, we will invite anywhere from 8 to 25 people over. In the summer, it's great because we, as you know, Carrie's been there, we have this wraparound porch, and we can fit about 25 to 30 people there.
That's a big commitment. That's a lot of people.
It is, and we always overcook. Yep. And Bertrand gets, you know, it's funny because I'm not going to name names, but certain people we invite, which I'll just, generally speaking, if we have a new guest, then we will get a little more nervous, obviously, and we'll aim a little higher, and we'll have, you know, 6 dishes, and Bertrand will be like, we don't have enough. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, if we make 3 dishes is really all, in my opinion, you should need. Not, you know, with all due respect to Dan Barber's movement, a salad, a meat, and some kind of summer side or something. But then if, you know, some fancy person who we know about and we just met is coming, we'll end up making more.
Have you made friends with Ruth Reichel up there yet?
I introduced myself to her in Great Barrington, outside Rubiner's Cheese Shop. I reminded her that I was the one with you when you saw her in the parking lot at Guido's. We have not made friends. I should invite her.
You should. But I remember that day you were kind of like stalking her and you'd seen her before and you were afraid to say hello, weren't you? No?
I don't think that was me.
That wasn't you? That must have been another friend who was stalking Ruth.
I will see her at the farmer's market in Great Barrington, and we have a number of friends in common, mm-hmm. so I should invite her. But no, I kind of leave her alone. When you see a person like that, you just think they probably would appreciate saying I'm a big fan, but I feel like everything's kind of off duty up there, so.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Ruth would be happy to hear from you.
All right.
Say hi next time.
I will.
So where do you get your recipes from?
Everywhere. We open... Adelenge's books quite a lot. Electra Weideman's book I've been perusing. Kalu Henry's book. But as far as, like, I was listening to your Melissa Clark interview, I do not have a library of them. We have a stack of them. But I think we're usually lazy and we just Google either a chef's name or a food that we're interested in. And as a matter of fact, and a lot of it is either restaurant inspiration, like, we could make this. Which, again, is not insulting a chef, but it's more like, let's try. Like, let's figure out the flavors. And I have not been beneath calling a restaurant. I did this with One Lucky Duck once, which is no longer with us, unfortunately. And I wanted to make their spicy sesame salad. And I didn't know what kind of oil they used. It was sesame. It was obviously sesame. But, again, fraudulence, okay? This was, to be fair, many years ago. But I called them up, and I was like, hi, I'm allergic to certain oils. Can you tell me what kind of oil you use in the sesame salad? And they told me, and then we're like, done. So,
wow, I never thought about calling a restaurant or an
just
eatery.
Just like feign allergies.
Or just ask. Yeah.
Probably.
They might be happy to tell you.
Yeah, well, there's my insecurity.
Okay. So tell us how you broke into magazines.
I was temping. Which I don't even know if they exist anymore. This was the 80s. And I was a horrible waitress, so I couldn't do that in college. So I typed everyone's papers. And my sister worked at GQ magazine at the time. And she said, all of our temps come from this agency. Go to this agency. So I was a fast typist. And I got sent to all these random places the summer before my senior year of college. And then when I, Christmas break, senior year, I got placed at Glamour magazine. Beauty department. And I was not a beauty junkie. I was not into beauty at all. I still can't put on mascara to save my life. But this was back before there were security check-ins of buildings, and I actually walked right into Condé Nast, took the elevator up to Glamour magazine, and was like, hi, remember me? And they needed a new assistant, and I got the job because I had 2 weeks more experience than anyone else did.
Wow.
And then I just kind of stayed, you know, and just stayed in the industry. And even though I'm not, like, beauty obsessed, I think my cynicism probably helps because I don't fall for every claim, hook, line, and sinker.
So you're not a big follower of trends?
No, I'm a big follower of, yeah, I will observe the trends. I don't necessarily adhere to them. How's that?
You've never dyed your hair pink?
Correct.
Yet. There's still time. There's still time. So after Glamour, you went to Jane magazine. Mm-hmm. And for those who don't know, maybe you remember Sassy magazine, Jane Pratt, mm-hmm. the founder, then did Jane. And what was that like? Because that was a lot
crazy.
Of early girl power
it was,
over there.
It was great. She, you know, she's a cult figure. And if you're a magazine editor, I think every magazine editor should experience a startup, as you well know. I mean, it's a lot of headaches, but you have to do everything because you're such a bare bones staff. So, you know, and she is probably still friends with Drew Barrymore and Jimmy Fallon and Mark Ruffalo. And like people would come into the office and Gwyneth maybe even, I don't know, but it was, I laughed a lot. It was great that we all got to write in our own voice. And it was the first magazine. I had been at Mademoiselle before Jane also, and I never got to write, and she really championed us using our voices, writing in our own voices, which I am eternally grateful because I'd never really tapped it before.
But she wasn't. It was the whole idea of blogging before
right.
blogs existed.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. We are going to take a quick break, and then we will be right back to hear more about Jane Larkworthy and her colorful career.
Le Cordon Bleu, the renowned culinary school, was founded in Paris 122 years ago by a young journalist named Mademoiselle d'Estelle. In 1895, she launched the first weekly culinary magazine called La Cuisinière Le Cordon Bleu. She invited subscribers to take part in free cooking lessons with the chefs featured in her magazine, and from there, the school was born. In the years since, Le Cordon Bleu's world-class instructors have taught French classical culinary techniques to everyone from home enthusiasts to food world legends. If you've dreamt of attending culinary school, maybe it's time to quit that boring corporate job and check out one of Le Cordon Bleu's 35 locations around the world. Or add a short workshop or weekend program at one of its schools to your next vacation. Visit cordonbleu.edu. for course descriptions, dates, and online registration. It's all possible at Le Cordon Bleu.
Hey there, Bomb Squad. This is Donnie Yen from Team Cherry Bomb. My dog Teddy is a regular at Cherry Bomb HQ, and I care about where his food comes from, just as I do my own. That's why Teddy and I are excited about Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Castor and Pollock's new line of pet food is made from real ingredients, like grass-fed beef and wild-caught salmon. I love that they care about Teddy as much as I do. And as for Teddy, he gives it 2 paws up.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. We're here with Jane Larkworthy, a.k.a. the Fraudulent Chef, and a major beauty editor in the beauty industry. That's how Jane and I got to be friends originally. We met when mm-hmm. I was working at Women's Wear Daily, and Jane was at Jane. Which was always funny when you had to introduce yourself as Jane from Jane.
If I had a nickel for every time someone said, does everyone on the staff have to be named Jane?
And your answer was
rich.
No. So as a beauty editor, you wrote a lot about health and fitness. Mm-hmm. And I was curious if that had an impact on your own diet.
Yes and no. Fitness, sorta. I am preternaturally lazy. The idea of being in a spinning room, I can't think of a worse fate. But ironically, maybe not ironically, I don't know what the word is, I road bike. So I will ride 30 miles on the weekend, and I know people think that's very dangerous, but like I just love feeling the wind against my face. And
Wait, it's dangerous just, because it's just dangerous to...
You get hit by a car.
Oh, okay.
Just being on a road bike, you know, it is a dangerous sport, I guess, in the grand scheme of things. But anyway, yeah, I can't do that. But back to health, I don't think I ever wrote about this, but I read about it, the 5-2 diet, which came out of London, and I think it's been, I read about it about 4 years ago, maybe it's older than that, and it has become my way of life, which is essentially 2 days out of the week, so long as they're not consistent, you basically fast or cleanse. Women, the rule is 400 calories for the day. Men is 500 calories. I don't measure my calories, but on those days, I don't have a full meal. I snack. And so I'll have cashews or my favorite candy, turkey jerky. Or I try to stay away from dried fruit because there's a lot of sugar in that. But I ran it by Frank Lipman, the nutritionist, and he was like, no, it's great. It's great. Like, you're giving your body's metabolism a rest. And, like, he was all for it. So the funny thing is, theoretically, on the days that you aren't cleansing, you're supposed to be able to eat whatever you want. But I don't trust it enough. So not only am I still sort of mindful about what I'm having on those, you know, eat it whatever you want days, but sometimes I get a little off the rails is too strong a term, but sometimes I do more of a 4-3 diet.
Got it.
So like Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays, I'll cleanse if the pants are getting a little too tight.
Well, saying you can have whatever you want, sometimes that's a
yeah.
little vague.
Which is probably why there is an obesity problem, because people probably take it fully literally.
And some other reasons too, definitely.
Sugar,
but it
sugar,
makes,
sugar, sugar.
It does make a lot of sense. And I know you mm-hmm. followed it for a long time, and it seems
do.
To be working for you.
You're very nice. I still do. And I proselytize about it all the time. And a lot of people are like, oh, I tried it. I gained 5 pounds. But it worked for me.
Yeah. I think everybody just has to find the thing that works for them. So do you have sweet tooth? For some reason, I can't remember if you do or don't.
Ish. I'm not a big dessert person.
Not as bad as mine. Okay.
But I love my licorice.
You love your licorice.
Yeah.
Have you had that salty?
Yes.
You have the salty licorice. I tried that for the first time. I brought some back to the office when I had a layover in Reykjavik.
Oh, funny.
And I was sort of hoping that there would be a Reykjavik restaurant where I could go try Icelandic cuisine, but the best I could do was some salty licorice from the gift shop.
In the airport.
Exactly.
I'm a chocolate-covered pretzels kind of person. I know Melissa Clark mentioned that. That's my ideal combination of salty and sweet.
Okay. So I wasn't sure about the sweet tooth, but I know what you don't eat. You don't eat fish.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd that come from?
I don't know. Yes, I do. Even though I grew up about 10 minutes from the beach, growing up in the 60s and 70s, the fish was all canned. And so it was disgusting. And I remember sitting in my parents' at the dinner table and with my salmon patty in front of me and, you know, the hours clicking by, and I couldn't leave the table until I took a bite. But I have tried various types of seafood and it all tastes like fish to me. And you were talking about...
That's because it is all fish. Sorry, couldn't resist.
It all tastes fishy to me, okay? And, you know, and so it's like, it tastes like chicken, tastes like, you know, try swordfish. It doesn't taste fishy. I taste the fish.
Taste the anything else on your don't eat list?
Oh, lots, but we don't have enough time.
Yeah. How do you deal with, since you entertain a lot, how do you deal with everybody's preferences these days?
You just ask. I just ask if there's any don'ts or
when
knows.
You send out the invitation, you ask, or you
mm-hmm.
ask individually?
We often have the same people over a lot, so Like, I know who's a red flag, who isn't. Like, we have friends who are flexitarians. So we will make more veggie dishes when we know that Jin and Dave are coming over. But for the most part, they're not picky.
Okay. Are you picky?
Mm-hmm. I always have been. I know. My boyfriend in college said, you have a very unsophisticated palate. And I guess I do. It's I'm not proud of it.
Well, this is a good segue over to your mom. Mm-hmm. So you wrote a beautiful essay for us about your mother.
Thank you.
Very sadly, you lost your mom when you were very young and she was young. But it sounded like your mom was a fairly sophisticated cook.
In my mind, she was. And, you know, talking to the neighborhood kids, you know, a few years afterwards, they all were like, oh, Mrs. Larkworthy's food. She was the best cook. And in this piece that I talk about, the ingredients that she used were definitely not of Julia Child level. But yes, I loved just about everything she made except those salmon patties.
So Jane wrote this beautiful essay. It's in, for those of you who have our second issue, yes,
second.
In the second issue with Erin McKenna on the cover. We have asked Jane to read the essay. So this is the first time Jane is actually reading this out loud, so bear with her.
There might be some words I can't pronounce.
But it's really beautiful, and we just thought it would be nice if we could hear it in Jane's own words.
Thank you. Okay, it's called The Missing Ingredient. Sometimes the home-cooked meals of your childhood aren't what you remember, and sometimes it doesn't matter. Okay. Growing up in a modest suburban household where coupons were clipped and a vacation meant a week upstate at grandma's, certain luxuries were not part of my childhood. We didn't belong to a country club, we had one car, and it was American, and we never went out to eat. Sunday dinner at Royal Hunan Palace or giving mom the night off at the Greek diner was something other families indulged in. Of course, I envied my friend's early mastering of chopsticks and scrapbook inclusions of fortune cookie strips, but a home-cooked Midge Larkworthy meal was anything but a consolation prize. Once a week, Mom wrote out the schedule of nightly menus on a yellow memo pad, mingling family favorites with a few loftier attempts borrowed from the New York Times cookbook. Coq au vin, fried chicken, tagine, beef grenadine, Salisbury steak. While other moms in the neighborhood stirred hamburger helper into frying pans of chopped chuck or poured jars of Buitoni marinara sauce over boiled pasta, it was typical to find homemade bread dough brimming over a yellowware bowl and cubes of sherry-soaked tenderloin marinating in a Pyrex dish in our kitchen. Mom experimented with ingredients we'd never heard of, such as curry and pork belly, and she poured wine into her sauces. I often came home from school greeted by the smell of bread cooling on racks on the butcher block or the simmering mystery of a rosemary-scented reduction bubbling away in a cast-iron skillet. Of course, every kid probably thinks her mom is the best cook, and I could only imagine what I knew. And I knew I didn't like to eat at my friends' houses because their moms added Lipton's onion soup mix into their hamburgers or slapped two slabs of bologna and Goulden's mustard or, worse yet, Miracle Whip between two pieces of Wonder Bread. These flavors were unfamiliar and cold, so I rejected them. Always a quick excuse at the ready for not being able to stay. I'm laughing at my own story. With the exception of two of her dishes, tuna spaghetti and salmon patties, oh, there they are, I blame my lifelong hatred of seafood on them. I happily clean my plate. Mom's, all right, I read that wrong. With the exception of two of her dishes, tuna spaghetti and salmon patties, parentheses, I blame my lifelong hatred of seafood on them, I happily cleaned my plate. Mom's dishes were fresh from the oven warm, exploding with comforting flavors like cinnamon, garlic, thyme. Like the flannel sheets she sewed and hugged my bed, or the crackling fire she started every evening in the winter, in anticipation of Dad's arrival from work, Mom's meals were cozy. Mom's meals made me feel safe. They kept the bad news from me for the most part. My siblings, Kate and Pete, were told that the cancer had returned, but the family decided to hold off on telling the youngest child until Mom went into the hospital for the last time. I'm afraid I've got bad news for you, kiddo, Dad said when I greeted him in the driveway one night in early June. That safe feeling was ending. In her final days, when the kitchen housed no lively aromas, I tried to revive it, and her, by opening her recipe box. It was not a smooth passing of the torch. Impatience and a general talent for cursory glances at instructions prevented me from succeeding at that beef grenadine. An attempt at her French fries resulted in a small contained fire in the kitchen. So true, I remember. In the first few years after her passing, Dad and I would attempt one of her culinary hits when I came home on college breaks. We'd roll up our sleeves, lay out all the ingredients, and trudge through her directions for city chicken legs, which, by the way, didn't contain chicken, or porcupines, which weren't made from pork. Ours never came out tasting as good as hers, and each disappointment lessened the urge to try again. Thinking back on it, recreating a midge meal was probably too painful for him. To conjure up the familiarity of a signature dish without also getting its chef in the deal was unfair. A part of her resurfaced, but we didn't really have her. There was no high-pitched laughter. "Oh, Billy, you're going to burn the sauce. It says simmer." No turtleneck sweater and plaid pants. No warm, nuzzly hint of Norelle, and no gentle guidance to set us back on course with the marinade. 25 years later, we lost Dad. My siblings and I made the trek out to the house and set about preparing it for the realtor. We each took our designated heirlooms. Pete got Grandpa Jasper's rocking chair. Kate got Mom's portrait off the bedroom wall. I got the monogram silver. Tucked away in an upper cupboard, above the broom closet, I found the recipe box. Inside were all the magic cards. Nana's goulash, city chicken legs, honey buns, marble cake, snowball cookies. When I got back to my apartment, I pulled out my own yellow memo pad, ready to restart the grocery list she had stopped making so long ago. Upon closer inspection of the recipe's ingredients, my pen froze. Crisco, accent, Wesson, mighty fine tapioca pudding, Pennsylvania Dutch noodles. It was one long gastronomic anachronism. A gastronachronism. At first, reading all these words I hadn't seen for 25 years made me laugh at my idealized memories. Campbell's tomato soup, garlic powder, and bouillon cubes weren't exactly homemade ingredients. This was quickly followed by concern for my health and that of my siblings. How much trans fat and processed food had we ingested during our formative years? Most of these foods still exist, they just don't exist in my pantry. Moreover, my marriage to a man of staunch, salubrious ways has resulted in a kitchen where the only sugar is raw, the tomato sauce is from scratch, and butter has been replaced with olive oil. We don't let Mrs. Dash or Parquet into our home. We went about replacing each supermarket relic on the ingredient list with a healthier alternative. Chopped garlic stepped in for accent. Brown rice replaced minute rice, and olive oil replaced just about everything else. Mom's dishes now exist alongside... Mom's dishes now exist alongside the recipes that have become our new lineup of family hits. Butternut squash lasagna, kale and apple salad, vegetable Napoleons, balsamic roasted strawberries. When we feed our friends and family, Midge still lingers. In the linen napkins, the patchwork tablecloth she made 40 years ago, and the monogram silver. But I don't envision 1970s Mom. I see her as if she were still with us today. Frail at nearly 85. Oh, God, I'm getting well upset.
Make me cry.
I'm almost done, guys. Sorry. Frail at nearly 85, but sturdy. She'd be cozied up on her sofa, perhaps knitting a sweater for our daughter. Looking over, she'd ask my husband to tell her once again how much that syrupy aged balsamic vinegar he used in his salad dressing costs. "Have you tried just thickening regular vinegar with Knox?" she might suggest. "Oh, Midge," my husband would laugh, shaking his head. Hearing my husband call my mother Midge, for that, I would eat an entire salmon patty. I'm not sure about that. Okay, I'm done.
That was mean.
Thank you for reading that.
Thanks for letting me. Whoa. As I started reading, I was like, okay, this is going to get hard.
Aww.
Picture something.
Well, I mean, I can't imagine how hard it was. You were the baby. You lost your mom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Reading, I'm going to make... we're all crying now. I'm going to make myself cry saying this, but... hearing you read that out loud really made me sad because I just thought your mother had so much joy in the kitchen and she missed. we're all sitting here crying.
She missed seeing me enjoy cooking.
She missed seeing you enjoy cooking, but at the same time, your mom loved the kitchen. She missed this whole revolution.
I know. I think about that.
You know, she missed it. She was cooking with canned seafood because nobody was really celebrating the seafood that was pulled out of the ocean miles away.
I know, it's crazy.
And the farmers markets and all the beautiful produce, even from, you know, people don't think of Long Island as being a place where beautiful produce comes from, but it does.
But it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it? It really struck me when you said, when you went back after your dad had passed away and you, you know, you and each of your siblings had the thing that, you know, was meaningful to you that you left with, but you happened to find this recipe box. Did you know it was?
I did.
You did know it was there.
I did. And, you know, my father and I would reach up and go through it, and my brother and I would too, like try to make the Christmas cookies and stuff. But I also hadn't been bitten by the bug, by the cooking bug, until almost decades later. It's kind of strange. Oh, no, not after my father passed, but... Yeah, not until like my late 30s did I really get into it. It's weird what bites you.
Do you think it's, I mean, this is a very personal question, but do you think it's because your mom was such a part of the kitchen life?
Maybe.
In your home that you just didn't want to...
Maybe Dr. Diamond. Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. But I, without being sounding heartless, I don't think that is it, because I think... Oh, maybe it is. Who knows? But I think we all have someone in our lives, aside from a parent, who gets us into it, whatever that passion is. And I think I was too young to be into it. I was 17 when she died, so I was kind of just, you know, all I cared about was boys and which college to get into. So it wasn't, and it was the 80s, so the food explosion hadn't happened yet, so it wasn't cool. I think that's probably what it really was. Cooking wasn't cool. Why would I be into it? Like you and Lisa Clark talk, like it was connected to home ec. So it was not this thing that the cool kids did.
Right, and women were trying to get out of the kitchen.
Exactly.
At that point, not exactly. Get back into the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really touching that you thought every single thing your mom made was homemade.
I know.
Did you think she was making homemade egg noodles?
No. I think it's just we have romantic notions of mm-hmm. the past. And I think I didn't think the noodles she made were homemade, but I just think it was right out of like the Waltons or a Pepperidge Farm ad or something. It was just like the steam was rising from the food. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my mother was also a fashion designer, which sounds crazy, but she made these patchwork hostess skirts that she sold at Bergdorf Goodman. I have a photograph of one of her skirts on a mannequin on the first floor of Bergdorf Goodman. But I never called my mother a fashion designer. She made these skirts to get my brother through college. So it's just so funny.
She just did it on the side?
She was always very crafty. She was always like, she sewed all my clothes. And of course, I hated them all because they weren't cool. If, you know, what I'd give to have them all now. But yeah, she made everything. She made everything. She made my sister's prom dress. She made one of my prom dresses. Like, it was just amazing. And have I inherited any of that side? Hell no.
Not at all. Not at all. But you do have one of those skirts. I feel like I saw you.
I have a bunch of them. Mm-hmm. And I pull them out every once in a while. Yeah.
I remember seeing you wear one. Let's talk about your husband.
Okay.
Who is one of the greatest guys on the planet.
Thank you. I think so too.
And has he had a big impact on how you cook? Because he's a super healthy eater.
Super healthy eater. Yeah. Yeah, like I said in the article, we do have butter and it's Kerrygold. But we olive oil everything. Like he would just eat it by the spoonful.
Did you turn that into, was that a verb? We olive oil everything?
I did.
I like that.
I did. And he loves to roll up his sleeves for the kitchen, to get into the kitchen too. Someone asked me the other night when we had people over and we had guests for the first time, and someone said, you know, who's the chef? And it is very 50-50. But he errs more on the side of health than I do. So he'll find this Adelenke recipe in Plenty that just won't excite me because it just seems a little too healthy for me. But, you know, he'll make it and it'll be part of the repertoire.
So I should point out this has absolutely nothing to do with food, but everything to do with life. You met Bertrand online.
Yes.
And you encouraged me to go online.
Yes, pay it forward.
I met my significant other. So for those of you out there who have a lot of trepidation about online dating, Jane and I are more or less two success stories.
All it takes is one.
That's
like,
true.
A lot of frogs, but all it takes is one. I never would have met my husband. He was spending every weekend at Astrid's soccer games or Luke's hockey games. Mm-hmm. Like, we never would have crossed paths.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny, isn't it?
I know. It is.
So be bold, people. That's the...
Yeah.
Be bold in life. Be bold in the kitchen. I think that is the Jane Larkworthy example that she sets. Even though she thinks she's a fraud.
Exactly.
I
actually am bold. I think I might be bold. I'm fraudulently bold. Oh, God. That word.
It could be your next blog post. Should people look at your blog? I know you don't, blog that often.
Yes, please. I know.
Often,
I've been really busy. Well, happily, the Coverteur has taken up a lot of my time, and this whole freelance life that I have now is a tricky thing to juggle. But I'm determined to get back into blogging again because I have so many stories to tell. And I like to share it. I'm also on Instagram. Fraudulent's also on Instagram. So... Wait, what was your question?
My question was, are you going to blog more?
And yes, I'm going to blog more. And my biggest cheerleader is Carrie. I'll never forget when I was telling you I have like 7 followers. You asked me how often I blog. I'm like, I don't know, once a month. And you're like, 3 times a week. It can even be a super short one. It doesn't matter. And then you like rattled off 7 things for me to write about. And I think I followed maybe 3 of them, which is, almost 50%. But yeah, you are the best cheerleader.
Well, I think you throw yourself into your blog the same way you throw yourself into those dinner parties for 25 people, which is incredible. You don't just phone it in and write a little post.
Yeah.
You write real stories on your blog.
I do.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah. And it just doesn't feel organic to do like, now that it's raining outside, the 8 best rain boots. It doesn't feel satisfying.
No. No, but everybody should check out thefraudulentchef.com.
Thank you.
.com.
Yep.
Follow Jane's adventures on Instagram. You're an enthusiastic Instagrammer.
I am.
At Jane Larkworthy,
mm-hmm.
at The Fraudulent Chef.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jane has the cutest standard poodle
mm-hmm.
named Remy.
Mm-hmm.
And you can follow Remy at My Higher Standard.
Yes.
Why My Higher Standard?
It was first Daily Remy, which I don't know. I just didn't like it. I just kind of wanted to elevate her handle because... You get the joke of higher standards, obviously. I dress her up in fashion a lot. And
we save this to the very end so people wouldn't turn off the radio. But yes, Jane from time to time dresses her dog in human clothes.
It takes 30 seconds. Exactly. That is definitely not a poodle bark. Poodle bark is more like... All right.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, Dave. Can I keep going?
Yes, keep going.
I'm sure she doesn't enjoy it, but it takes about 30 seconds for me to put a hat on her and maybe wrap some dress around her. Stay, stay, stay. And she'll just freeze. And it's because she, dogs, or pets, unconditional love. So long as I'm there with her, she actually is going to be, I think, in Vogue Brazil.
Ooh.
One of our neighbors in the Berkshires is a photographer, and he was shooting collections at his house. And I walked by, and he's like, oh, I'd love to have your dog. So, yeah, she's wearing a crown, Dolce & Gabbana crown, hopefully.
So all those years of putting your dog in human clothes is paying off.
Although we did not get paid. But, yeah, it was a fun moment.
Oh. Anyway, Jane, thank you so much.
Thanks
for
having me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for being a great friend over the years.
Oh, make me cry again.
I know you said that was very sweet that you said I'm in your lifeboat. You're in mine. You've stuck by me through thick and thin, so thank you.
You too. We're going to cry again, everybody.
That's it for today's show. Radio Cherry Bomb is engineered by the one and only Dave Tatasciore. Thank you to Le Cordon Bleu for making the season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. Don't forget to enter our Le Cordon Bleu sweepstakes going on right now. To enter, visit cherrybomb.com and click on the banner. You could win a trip to Paris, London, or Ottawa, plus culinary classes and spending money. You'd be crazy not to enter, so don't delay. Jane, which city would you pick? Paris, London, or Ottawa?
London.
I thought you were going to say Ottawa because I'm guessing you've never been there, and you've been to London and Paris a lot.
I haven't been to London in such a long time. And hearing your podcast about it last week makes me want to go back.
You got to go. So many great girls. And thank you to Castor and Pollux for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. If you are a devoted pet parent like me, Donna, and obviously Jane, be sure to check out Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients from Castor and Pollux. Also, be sure to check out the latest issue of Cherry Bomb featuring our Martha Stewart cover story. There's lots of advice and straight talk from the one and only Martha. You can find Cherry Bomb in Barnes & Noble locations across the country, as well as indie bookstores like Omnivore Books in San Francisco, Kitchen Arts and Letters in Manhattan, and Book Larder in Seattle. Be sure to tune in next week to catch our conversation with Samin Nosrat, author of this year's hottest cookbook, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. Thanks for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.
Hi, I'm Carla Perez Gallardo.
And I'm Hannah Black.
And we're chef owners of Lil Deb's Oasis,
which is a restaurant in Hudson, New York.
Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network.
To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com.
You know who I think is the bomb?
Mona Talbot, who's the chef and owner of Talbot & Arding. It's a store and caterer based out of Hudson, New York.
She supports women and the arts, and she gets it.